Mr. Edwards, real nerd. We were talking about the events of the 17th of August 1944 when you were wounded, shot in the in the legs, multiple small wounds in the legs, after your tank had been hit and sort of brewed up. And you were crawling back towards cover.
We both crawled across the field and got to the hedge at the other side of the field. And there was an infantry patrol hiding behind the hedge. One of them showed his face at a gap and said, "This way, mate." So we crawled through the gap that he'd indicated. And at the other side of the hedge, I tried to stand up to walk and I couldn't. I just fell on the ground. Anyway, I crawled and we both sort of settled down on a grassy bank the other side of the hedge. And we were there, I don't know how long. The infantry disappeared and the tanks move off. It was all just very quiet and it went dark. And as it was going dark, a corporal arrived. He was a medic corporal from the infantry. And he looked at us and he cut our trouser legs off and did a good bandaging job on us. I'd put dressings on, but they dragged off as I've been crawling, they dragged off. Anyway, he did a good bandaging job on us.
Were you in pain or was it numb?
Can't remember. I just felt tired. I could have gone to sleep. In fact, I was probably sleepy. Whether it was the wounds or the shock or the loss of blood or what, I don't know. I just felt sleepy. I could have gone to sleep and I was at peace with the world. Anyway, this corporal having bandages, to put our bandages on, he disappeared and he came after a while, sometime, he came back with another chap and a stretcher. And they put Taffy on the stretcher and carried him off. They said, "We'll be back." So, well, they did come back later, and I thought, I wonder how long they'll be with. Anyway, they came back later, and it was pitch dark when they came back. How they found me, I don't know, because it was all just fields, nothing to go by. Anyway, they carried me back then, back to the Scissor Bridge, which must have been about a third of a mile or more, through the dark. And at across the Scissor Bridge there was a scout car waiting, and they hoisted the stretcher up on top of this scout car, and the corporal sat in the scout car with his arms across, his body across me to stop me falling off, while they drove me back to the dressing station. At the dressing station I was there with Taffy, and the gunner, who we hadn't seen, came to see us. He got his hands bandaged up. He said he jumped out of immediately and run like hell and got away with it. So he'd been very quick and got away with it, but he got burns around his hands, on his hands. Anyway, we all had a few words and a cup of, and they gave us a mug of tea, and I can remember it was late on, maybe I suppose about 1 o'clock or something in the morning, I was loaded into an ambulance. There was four of us in the ambulance on stretchers and it was dark inside and quiet except for a German. There was a German on the bottom. I was on the top stretcher, and on the bottom stretcher was a German, and he was moaning every now and then, the same Wasser, Wasser, so he was dying of thirst, I reckon. Anyway, we travelled all night then. It must have been a convoy of ambulance, because it was all stop, start and crawl and stop and start and rough roads and all sorts in the night. Next morning, about 5, the driver, the column must have stopped. The driver opened the back door and said, "Are you all right?" I said, "The German's dying of thirst." Oh, he says, "It's all right, you'll soon be there," he said, so, and shut the door again. So it was a waste of time asking us, I reckon. And about 6-ish, we arrived at the dressing station, which was where it was. It was somewhere not far from the coast. A big hospital, a field hospital rather, I'm sorry. And there was about 8 ambulances, and all the ambulance drivers carried all the stretchers into a big marquee. There was about 30 of us there, 20 odd to 30 anyway, all laid out on the grass in this marquee. And they went off and left us there. Anyway, eventually the hospital people arrived and got us into wards during the morning. I was there for 4 days. Well, at the end, on the night of the first day, I was put to sleep, and went into the operating theatre, and the surgeon operated on my legs, and he said he'd dug out all sorts of metal and rocks out of it. And he says there's still plenty left in, and it'll stay there a long time. Well, I think I've still got bits in now, bits of something. And then
I was there about 4 days.
I was there 4 days, and during that time I had to have a penicillin injection every 3 hours, night and day. And these M&B tablets, which was an antibiotic, 3 times a day. So the effect of the antibiotic made me feel pretty lousy. And I didn't get any sleep. I didn't sleep well anyway. And we'd been woken up every 3 hours in the night. I didn't get to sleep. And it was very hot under the... It was a canvas hospital, so it was very hot in the daytime. And I had no appetite, and I felt pretty lousy. But anyway, the end of the 4 days, took 4 of us in an ambulance to the beach and loaded us on a tank landing craft. And the tank landing craft was arranged so that they could have... there were racks all the way around, so that when they were empty of tanks, they could put stretchers on all these racks. And there must have been 100 or more of us on stretchers all around the inside of this tank landing craft.
So this would be about the 22nd?
Possibly.
4 days.
I would say probably, yeah. That was 22nd. And the next day, we didn't sail until the next morning. Then we sailed all day and arrived at Gosport in the evening, late evening, and they unloaded us off. Took a long time to unload everybody off. Onto a train, and we finished up at in a Canadian hospital at Farnborough. From the train, they took us to the hospital in buses. They were converted, old buses that were converted to carry stretchers. They took us to this Canadian hospital at Farnborough. Got there about 3 a.m, and next morning I woke up and had breakfast, and I thought, what a night. It was so clean and sunshine shining through the window. I thought, what a nice place this is. Anyway, after breakfast I slept most of the day until the afternoon, and in the evening they took us out from there, put us on these converted buses again, took us to the railway station about 11 o'clock at night, loaded us onto a hospital train. There were lots of us on this hospital train, and we didn't know where it was going. Opposite me was a commando, and he said, he was a Geordie, he said, all the crew of this train are Geordies, and the staff are Geordies, he says. Newcastle, here we come, roll on Newcastle, here we come. Anyway, we travelled all night, and the next morning, about 10 o'clock, we rolled into what was Piccadilly Station, Manchester. It was called London Road then. And a lot of converted buses were waiting for us. They must have had a lot ready that took stretchers, and they took us to various hospitals around Manchester, and I was put in Manchester Royal. I was there for about 4 weeks.
And what sort of treatment did you get to the Manchester Royal Hospital?
Well, to start with, my left leg was bent at 90 degrees. It was sort of stiff in that, and I couldn't move it. So they put it in a splint to stretch it. They had to stretch it a little bit each day to get it straightened out. And they put dressings on my legs. I didn't have to have any more penicillin or M&B, thank goodness. Well, they just did the dressings. And about 3.5 weeks later, a physiotherapist came and gave me a few exercises and a bit of massage. And I was able to walk a few yards, which was great, because then you could take myself to the toilet instead of having to use bottles and bedpans and all that business.
And then, did you have any visits?
Yeah. Oh yes. Well, when we got on the bus at the station, on this converted bus, I was thinking to myself, we'll get settled in at the hospital. I'll write my mother a letter and tell her I'm all right, but I'm in hospital. But there's a woman came round the bus, there was an attendant of some sort, and she came out checking everybody's name and address. I thought it was just for the record, but anyway, so they could send telegrams out. So that afternoon, my mother arrived with my youngest sister and in a bit of a flap because she didn't know what state I was in. If I could have written to her beforehand, I could have told her I was quite all right. Anyway, she came to visit me, and she came to visit me a few times. I mean, it wasn't easy because it was umpteen buses to get there. My father came just once while he worked all sorts of horrible shifts on the railways, so he couldn't make it. Uncle Tom, who was in the auxiliary fire service, he came to see me once. The boss from work came to see me once, and because they told him about it. And Jonathan Parson came to see me. He was actually visiting somebody else in the hospital, but he heard about me, so he came to see me. But that's about all, I think. But I wasn't very interested in visitors because my conversation ability was nil, and I was hopeless with people. And I knew what to, unless they had plenty of conversation, I was hopeless. So I wasn't happy about my visitors, believe it or not. I was better without visitors. Anyway, that was it. And after about 4 weeks, I could walk a few yards, as soon as anybody in the ward could walk, they had to help get the breakfast ready, because the night nurse used to have to cook the breakfast. And any walkers had to go in, help her cook it, and then go out and serve it to all the patients. So I was roped in for that for two or three mornings. And then I was moved to a convalescent hospital at Didsbury, which was a few miles away.
What was that like?
Very, very nice. It was the best bit of army I'd ever had, I think. It was. I was there about 3 or 4 weeks.
So this would be sort of September, October, would it?
It was September, I should imagine, late September. It was very nice. There was the food was plentiful, and nice food, nice dining room, nice food. We were two to a room, and you sort of received dressings. Oh, and there was a gym and a PT sergeant major, elderly chap. He gave us some gentle exercises in the gym, and those who could walk, he took us a short walk around in the afternoon, and it was very pleasant with us. And it was quite nice there. But while I was there, the Arnhem do was on, and I used to think, oh, the poor devil's having a hard time there while I'm having it easy. Yes. Anyway, my roommate had a pair of crutches, so I used to borrow a crutch off him and pretend it was a brain gun, go blazing away at the enemy with his crutch, thinking it was a brain gun. It was my contribution to Arnhem, I think, all I could do. And in October, after about 4 weeks there, 3 or 4 weeks, in October, I was moved to an army convalescent depot near Stoke, near Trenton Gardens, Stoke, which is a miserable place.
And what was miserable about it?
Well, it was a few nest nuts in a field a long way from anywhere, and it was.
But it's actually part of Trenton Gardens.
No, no, it was somewhere in a field, somewhere at the back of way, but a long way behind them. And I needed some handkerchiefs. I'd get very little kit from losing everything. So I needed some handkerchiefs. So there was a little naffy, so I went to ask her, and the naffy could have buy some handkerchiefs because it was the only place where you could get them. She said, and they were khaki handkerchiefs. Oh, she says, you have to get a note from signed by an officer. So I had to go to write a note out for the sergeant, to give to the sergeant major and to an officer to get signed. So I go to the naffy to get me six khaki handkerchiefs, because things like that were on coupons and all, you see. Anyway, this place, they said, was overcrowded, so we'd only been there maybe a week or so, and a gang of us were shipped out by train up to Scotland, and I finished up at the Army Convalescent Depot at Hamilton, which was on Hamilton Racecourse. There were two grandstands that had been boulded up at the front, decked inside and made into barrack rooms. So I was there for a while, and the convalescence there consisted of PT, and lots of PT and lots of games, and not football, but lots of other games, and running and Well, a bit of swimming and lots of trotting, just jogging on the roads and that. So all to get you fit, and you used to have a medical examination every Friday afternoon to see how you're going on. Anyway, after 2 weeks, I was upgraded and I moved to the first grandstand I was in was the 2 and 6 grandstand, but then I was moved up to the 5 shilling grandstand, where the same procedure, I still did all this PT and that getting fit business, but in this third week we had a long route march, and as well about 15 or 16 miles and 2 runs over an assault course, all to see if you were fit enough. And at the end of the week I was passed a medical examination again, and I was passed fit. fit for duty.
What, A1 or?
Well, fit for duty, what the category was, I wouldn't know. But then I had to move out of the high shilling grandstand into the stables then, so we're in the stables, a double bunk in each stable, just the bare bricks and cold, and didn't even have 2 doors, you know, the stable doors. Well, I was only had the top half, and lots of them just had half a stable door. What had happened to the others, I don't know. I think somebody had used them for fuel. And there was no lights in, and the ablutions was a trough in the middle of the stable yard, and it was freezing weather, and the taps were frozen up, so you couldn't get a wash and shave there. The only way you could get a wash and shave was at lunchtime when you went down to the nappy, in the nappy. By the way, after 6 days of this, it was pretty uncomfortable. I got a leave pass then, and I had to get the bus to Glasgow and the train from Glasgow to Manchester, and got into Manchester about 1:30 in the morning, and started walking home, and halfway home I picked up an all night bus and got home in the middle of the night for leave. Anyway, after leave went back to the had to report back to Catterick to a holding unit.
Now, how did you feel about the prospect of going back into production?
Quite happy. I was looking forward to getting back to the unit, because it was horrible being in all these other, after the convalescent hospital, it was very pleasant. It wasn't very nice in all these other places.
So you were at a holding unit in Catterick?
Catterick, a few over Christmas, after Christmas, moved to another holding unit at Chippenham, near Cambridge, where I first joined the regiment. That was a holding unit. And then we were moved from there to Tilbury. Spent the night in a tent, freezing weather, snow on the ground. The next morning we sailed over to Ostend. This is a party of us. Ostend, we were put in a few of us, we were split up, and my party, small party, was put in a disused factory in Ostend. We slept on the factory floor for a few days until somebody sorted things out, and then I was taken back to the unit. I returned to the unit.
So you got back to around about January?
No, I returned to the unit 8th of February. That's after all these holding units. 8th of February, I got back to the unit in Ypres.
Now, how had the unit changed?
Vastly. There was only about a quarter or a third of the original men in our squadron. All the others were replacements.
Had it changed the unit? Was it a different bunch, or?
Well, they were different, but I still felt as if I was back home, because one or two people were still the same. And
did they give you a reception? You know, I mean.
Oh no, no. We just arrived back, and somebody took. There was a chap called Jim. Jim Fraser and myself out of our squadron, and they put a lad with us we knew, and he took us to our billet, because we were all billeted in civilian houses, 2 or 3 to a house here all around the town.
So were you back to 3 Troop B Squadron, or what were you?
I wasn't in the troop, I was in B Squadron. And the next, they were there being, they were in Ypres being equipped with new Comet tanks.
Now, what did you think of the Comet tank? How was it different? What was better about it?
Well, to start with, it had a better gun than a better anti-tank gun than the Shermans. It had a better suspension, so it was more comfortable cross-country, and it was faster. It wasn't as high up At least it was nearly as high, but it didn't look as high. It looked a bit lower down. And that was the main thing about it. But I liked the look of them compared with the Sherman. I thought, well, they look more like a tank. I was just pleased to see them, that's all. But I felt more confident. When I was in them, I felt more confident as well.
Now, you weren't in the troop. Why was that?
Well, because I'd only just arrived and I'd been pushing it. I'd only just arrived back, you see. So, I mean, the first thing they did with me was to put me in a class to learn about the guns, and in a class to learn about a refresher course on the wireless sets, because they'd uprated the wireless sets. They'd made some modifications to them, which I had to learn. I've forgotten what they were, but I know it made it a bit easier to use. And I had to learn about the guns. And then I was then told I still wasn't in the troop for some weeks while I was there. But I worked on various tanks doing jobs. Then I was told that there was a vacancy for a gunner in this particular troop, which I can't think which it was, or a wireless operator in another troop. So I opted for the gunner in this troop, which I think was number one troop, but I couldn't swear to it. I can't remember the troop. So I became a gunner on this tank in this particular troop.
And why do you want it to be a gunner rather than a wireless operator? Because you'd always been, I mean, I know you were both, but...
Well, I could be both. I always had the impression from various things that people could have fired more. They could have put down more fire in various situations, and if they'd done a bit more shooting, it might have done a bit more good instead of being as conservative with the ammunition. It's not as if we were short of ammunition. We had stacks of ammunition all the time. And I used to think, well, I'll be a gunner, then I can shoot, I can do more shooting, I'll shoot when I want to. And also there's a few incidents when I can remember trying to tell Pat Kettridge, when he was a gunner, if we're expecting a Panther to come round the corner at short range, and I was saying, well, don't aim for the centre of the turret, allow for parallax. You've got to allow, aim to the about 2 feet to the right of the turret, base of the turret, to allow for parallax, because it's short range, and things like that. I was thinking, well, if I'm a gunner, I don't have to explain these things, I can do them myself. So I was a gunner.
And do you remember who the rest of the crew was in your tank?
Yes. Well, the commander was Paddy Purcell, Corporal Paddy Purcell. He was an Irish chap. I think he came from Southern Ireland. They sound like Southern Ireland to me.
He was
all right. He was he'd worked for he was a horsey man. He'd worked for a horse trainer called. Forgotten the name. He'd worked for a horse trainer, a well-known horse trainer, and he was into horses, and he used to talk about horses, and he got all the squadron's tanks named after horses, after race horses. He was all right. He wasn't clever, but he was a good, solid tank commander. I was quite happy with him. And then the driver was Bernard Bartlett, known to everybody as Spike. He was a big chap, very adventurous. The co-driver, I don't remember his name. He was quite a quiet young chap. And the loader was Trooper Thompson. I can't remember his first.
The wireless operator.
Loader was Trooper Thompson. I can't remember his first name. But he was a Scotch chap called Thompson. That's as I remember them.
How did they compare to your first crew, your other crews?
I would say quite different.
In what way?
Well, they were all different types of people. The driver was a Londoner, well, London area, and he talks out of London area, and he was entirely different to the people I'd had before. And the co-driver, I mean, our other co-driver had been a Welshman, and this chap, I don't know where he came from, but he was a quite a different sort of different person altogether.
Were they more competent?
No, they were all about the same, I would say.
Was it a less nervy crew?
Yes. Well, yes, because we weren't in Normandy. I mean, once you'd let... Not in Normandy, we were all on the nervy sort, because you never knew when you were going to get a shell through the side of the tank any second. But we were in Ypres and well away from the fighting, in Belgium well away from the fighting, so we were not nervy at all. And then we moved from Ypres.
Hey, what was Ypres like?
Very, very pleasant. I thought it was nice being there.
Were you in billets? Do you remember being billets?
Yeah, we were billeted in houses, civilian houses.
What was yours like?
It was a cafe, what they call a cafe, which was like a bar as well, a cafe bar. And at the back was a bit of a small holding, because the couple who had it, there was a Mr. and Mrs. Mr. was a fat, not so young. Mrs. was slim and about 30 or less, very slim, and she had a little girl, Francine, of 4. And she ran the house, and she ran the cafe when necessary at the front, and she used to feed an old man and a boy who ran the small holding at the back. She didn't have to feed us, but she didn't have to do anything for us much, because we used to feed at a central mess hall in the town.
And how did you get on with the Belgians, you know, your billet holders and the rest of them?
We got on very well. In fact, when I got there, the regiment had a bit of a hint of hero status, because they'd been to the Ardennes and sorted out the Ardennes. And so the Ardennes had all been sorted out when they got back. So, I mean, as far as the Belgians concerned, they'd had a lot to do with it. So they were sort of heroes, I think. So. They were sort of very well treated and well thought of. And when we left,
just before we go on, Ypres has a special place because of the First World War.
Yeah.
Were you very aware of that?
Oh yes, yes. I mean, somebody organised a trip for us around the various cemeteries, and they were very, very impressive. All these cemeteries.
Did you go on it?
Yes, so I saw these cemeteries, and also there was some trenches from the First World War that they'd preserved, and there was a bit of a museum attached and all this sort of thing. And I remember there was a Canadian cemetery where I think there's a lot of them being gassed and things like that. And then of course there's a Menin Gate there. I mean, that's very, very impressive. There's 54,000 names on there. I mean, I used to look around and think, God, for all these chaps, 54,000 names, no known grave. It's a very impressive thing, that.